From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Hello, I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Joel, I want to talk to you about vacuum tubes. And you and I have been around since the days of the glorious golden age of vacuum tubes. But I think we have some in our audience who are young enough that may not entirely understand or be familiar with vacuum tubes. Before we get started, could you give just a brief explanation for their sake of what a vacuum tube is?
Sure. A vacuum tube is a, think a light bulb is sort of the basic starting point, and that's actually where they started from in a way. And the idea is that not only will the filament of a vacuum tube put out light, it also emits electrons, or can emit electrons if made of the right material. By putting additional elements into the light bulb, you can have a device that acts like a rectifying diode. That was the first kind they had. And then by putting a control element, one or more control elements between the filament or cathode and the anode, you can actually control the electron flow. And by doing that, you can have a device that can be made to amplify or oscillate. In many ways, can act like a solid-state transistor or solid-state diode. Very similarly, in most respects, there's some subtle differences, not the least of which is size and weight and heat dissipation and so forth. But before the days of the transistor, which was actually invented in 1948 at Bell Labs and came into common use over the next decade, I would say, but not really heavily into the telecommunications arena till sometime towards the end of that period, I guess, from really just after World War One and possibly during World War One until the 50s, radio equipment was all composed of vacuum tube technology.
The common myth is that vacuum tubes are extinct today, but that's not true. I've seen them, especially in high-end audio. They're making a comeback there.
Yeah, it's very interesting because there are some people who really believe that the sound you get from a vacuum tube audio system is actually better in some respects than that which you can get from a solid-state audio system. I'm not sure I quite believe that. I have any problem with people who do, and I'm sure that they can sound just as good. And the only downside to it is they aren't making a lot of tubes anymore. So the tubes that are around are the ones that were made before they stopped being so popular. And there are some types that are getting scarce because the audio people are using them in great numbers, and therefore they're not available for hams who like to build tube equipment. So that's one downside to that. But other than that, I have no problem with hi-fi people. And there's, especially if on a cold day with a big amplifier with a lot of tubes, it can warm up the room in a couple of ways. So
yes, well, many years ago, I used to work in a recording studio, and the engineers, like myself, always had to contend with musicians who just swore that their tube amplifiers sounded warmer. That was the way they described it, warmer. And I got in an argument with one guy, and I said, well, warmer is distortion. That's what you're hearing is distortion. And he completely disagreed.
You know, I'm sure that you can make a vacuum tube amplifier that sounds very good, but you can make a solid-state amplifier that is almost perfect over its range.
Yes.
But not everybody likes perfect. I mean, if you have perfect reproduction, I mean, that's why they touch up photographs, you know, because
that's
perfection
right.
is not exactly what you're looking for. What you're looking for is a pleasant sound or a pleasant picture. If it makes you happy to listen to that, that's great. And I'm sure if somebody spent enough time at it, they could easily make a solid state amplifier that sounded exactly like the vacuum tube sound that you are aspiring for with your older gear. You know, that could be done. I don't know if anybody's worked on that or thought that was a big thing.
Yeah, I don't know.
Most people try to make audio equipment that is with minimal distortion, so it reproduces what was there in the first place. If what you like is a particular kind of distortion, you have to introduce that into the system somewhere. It's not an automatic. So, you know, it is what it is. That's all my opinion. Somebody else will say, I don't know what I'm talking about, and they're probably right. But
Well, I'm sure just what we've said in the last 5 minutes will stir up plenty of controversy among the audiophiles.
I'm sure it will. You know, you look at, we talked, I think, if we didn't, we should, about microphone equalization and so forth, that we can modify the sound that comes out of our audio system on our radio. And that's exactly the same kind of thing, that we're making it so that it sounds better to the person at the other end. And there's nothing wrong with that. If that sounds better and they can hear better, you can communicate better, or you punch through the interference better, or whatever, depending on what adjustments you make, you're adding distortion of a sort to the signal. You know, that's a very valid thing to do to meet particular objectives.
Yes.
Some other people have an objective of having distortion-free amplification and so forth. But the interesting thing is, oftentimes the major portions of distortion are not in the amplifier, but in the transducers at both ends, in the phonograph needle from the old days in the cartridge, mm-hmm. or in the loudspeaker, which has much more distortion usually than any amplifier over its major range. The two of those things together, whether it's a recording head on a tape deck or anything else. So the amplifier actually is usually not the limiting factor on distortion, unless you try to make it so.
Now, so far we've been talking about audio, but what about vacuum tubes and RF? I know that ham amplifiers, there are still some vacuum tube power amplifiers out there.
Absolutely. There are still plenty of them. I'd say the majority of high power legal limit amplifiers sold today are vacuum tube types. I'm just guessing at that. There are solid state ones, but the solid state ones have only been around for a few years, mm-hmm. even though they've been possible to make them for some time. The devices themselves were very expensive. They just weren't suitable on a price point for the amateur market, particularly. Now, that's changed over the years for two reasons. One, the solid state devices have become less expensive, and the other is the tubes are getting more expensive because there aren't as many of them. And there used to be a bunch of people in places like Russia and the Ukraine and China who made transmitting vacuum tubes. And there may even be still some in the United States. There's some very special ones that are made here. But most U.S. manufacturers of tubes have stopped production. Now, what that means is it's getting harder and harder to find quality vacuum tubes. So the manufacturers have to charge more for the products because they have more expensive tubes in them. Now, it's an interesting thing about this market. Back when they made tubes, they made so many of them that you can go to various places online and find so-called new old stock vacuum tubes, which are tubes that were produced maybe in the 50s or 60s or 70s, put in boxes and sitting on a warehouse shelf someplace, and somebody bought them, and now they're selling them on the internet through various sources. The interesting thing is they are selling for, in most cases, for the typical run-of-the-mill tube, a 6BA6 IF amplifier tube or something, for just about the same price that they were selling for in actual dollars as they were back in the 60s.
Really?
In other words, if it was $2.50 back then, it's $2.50 now. But keep in mind that $2.50 back then is really like $25 or something today. So they're a real bargain. You know, so if you have a vacuum tube receiver, as I have a number of them in the basement, it's not hard to get tubes to replace them. And that obviously, if we had this discussion in 100 years, which seems unlikely, that would change because they're not making new ones. But there's so many of them around that they're still available. Now, that isn't true for, let's say, one comes to mind is a Type 45, which was a power amplifier used mainly in audio systems, but it also can work in transmitters. And they were very popular for transmitters because you could pull them out of the broadcast receiver in the living room when nobody was looking. And also in the audio systems. And that's one of the things that the audiophiles, one of the tubes the audiophiles seem to like. And that's why those have gotten very expensive if you can find one at all.
Well, speaking of tubes, I have a tube question for you. But before we do, let's take a break and hear from DX Engineering, and we'll be right back.
I'll be right here.
Remember your first contact? The excitement of that first CQ? The exhilaration of making your first QSO? At DX Engineering, we know that feeling too. That's why we've committed to making your on-air experience the very best it can be. DX Engineering ships quickly, which means less station downtime, and we have free shipping for almost any order over $99. We've recently expanded our inventory, so you don't have to wait for the gear you need. DX Engineering has introduced all new radio products and revived legendary brands, all with the goal of helping you enjoy amateur radio. Most importantly, the DX Engineering team is here to help you. You've got a team of highly experienced hands ready to work out technical issues, answer questions, and help you optimize your station performance. That excitement you felt from the first contact, it can happen again and again with help from DX Engineering. DXEngineering.com. That's DXEngineering.com.
And we're back. And I have the promised tube question for
okay.
you, Joel.
I have some tube answers, too. We'll do those after.
Oh, good, good. I know that one of the popular tubes, especially for VHF applications, are the, well, the so-called ceramic tubes. I'm thinking in particular, for example, of a 4CX1500,
oh, yeah.
something of that. How do ceramic tubes in construction and function differ necessarily from glass tubes?
There are equivalents in both camps, like the 4X150 and the 4CX150. I think there's one of those, which were made, you know, first in glass and then in ceramic. I'm not sure about the interior structures. One of the things about those tubes is, unlike many tubes in which the anode is within the glass envelope, those ceramic tubes actually have an anode which is all the way out to the outside of the tube. So you can actually see, and if you're not careful, put your finger on the anode. Now, that raises another thing I wanted to mention. So the actual physical construction is somewhat different. I think there are a lot less problems with mechanical breakage. I don't know. Like, if you drop a glass vacuum tube or a light bulb, you stand a very strong yes. risk of having broken glass and little parts of things that you can't make use of anymore. A ceramic tube would not enjoy being dropped, but I don't think it's as likely to break as a glass tube. In terms of the way the elements inside the structure are constructed, I really don't know the differences between the different types. I mean, the glass tube, you can actually see in there and you see how they are.
Yes.
So you can sort of guess that it wouldn't be that different inside a ceramic tube. But in some cases, the VHF tubes do have fairly unique structures within the tube. So I guess, you know, they're very popular. There are a couple things you have to worry about with them. Well, one is that they do have a big anode out there, and you know,
yes.
that 4CX 3000 or something could have 3000 volts on the anode. So, you know, that can definitely ruin your day, which is one of the big differences that I need to stress between tube gear and solid state gear. For people who grew up after the tubes were popular and are used to working on equipment with 12, 15, maybe 25, 40 volts in them, you don't have to worry too much about electrocuting yourself. You can still have problems like arc welding things when you have jewelry on and burning your finger. I actually melted a wedding ring that was on my finger dealing with a giant 48-volt Minuteman missile support equipment battery. By holding my hand between the wrench that I was using to tighten the terminal and the steel floor that it was on, thinking my hand would provide sufficient insulation. And of course it did, but the wedding ring, I didn't think about that. And I actually melted about a third of it into molten gold in my finger. So you have to be very careful, even though you don't have high voltage, but you can sometimes have high current situations with lower voltages. But still, all in all, you're much less likely to be killed by getting your hands in a solid state radio than in a vacuum tube radio. And we're not talking just transmitters here. The typical shortwave receiver that we might encounter someplace of the day, the 50s, 60s kind of era, has a full-wave rectifier system in which the secondary voltage on the power transformer is typically roughly twice the B-plus voltage in the radio. So you're talking, you can have 700, 800 volts in the sure. power supply section that really easily. And, of course, if the capacitors have been charged and you turn it off and they don't discharge rapidly because it's missing a pleater resistor or something, you can have that voltage there for some time after you've turned the equipment off and unplugged it. So it's very important if you start getting into this, and especially if you're not used to it, keep one hand in your pocket so you won't have a path between one hand and the other, which is the absolute worst for your heart kind of thing. But you basically just want to make sure there's no voltage present. You know, make a safety stick that shorts out capacitors before you put your hand in there. Make sure there's nothing going on, because it's real easy to get killed in there. You don't want to do that too many times.
One thing I often hear, Joel, is that when it comes to dealing with, say, high SWR and other antenna issues, that tube amplifiers are allegedly more robust than solid state. Is that still the case?
I think they have a little more, they're a little more likely to forgive brief excesses, let's say. So with a transistor, if you exceed a voltage or a current rating briefly, it can be gone in a fraction of a second. Whereas with a tube amplifier, what will happen is you look in there and say, wow, those plates are bright red.
Yes, too I've much done current. That. Yeah. I have done that.
And, you know, if you leave them that way for a while, the things will start melting, but you have a little bit of time to recover. Maybe even more significant is the fact that solid state amplifiers tend to be of the no-tune variety, which is to say they're designed to drive a 50-ohm load. And if the antenna isn't 50-ohm, they have a problem with that and tend to shut down or go into alarm. So what you need is an antenna tuner between the amplifier and the antenna system. You know, most antennas have a fairly narrow band over which they have a good match to 50 ohms. So in many cases, an antenna tuner is almost required, even if the antenna has a nominal impedance of 50 ohms, especially if it's on 80 meters, which has a much wider bandwidth percentage-wise than most of our other bands. If it works well in the middle, it won't work well at the edges of the band. Now, vacuum tube transmitter is not a wideband transmitter, which is a mixed blessing. In other words, you have adjustments you have to make when you tune it up. The good news is most of the time those adjustments have a fair amount of variation in them so that you can actually match antennas that are not exactly 50 ohms. You can tune the plate tuning and plate loading capacitors in the output circuit. That's for a Pi network, which is most of the more recent amplifiers. And you can perhaps tune a 3 or 4 to 1 SWR so that the transmitter will drive power into it properly. Now, that doesn't solve any problems with transmission line loss or other things, but it allows you to operate without any additional equipment. Essentially, what you're doing is avoiding the extra antenna tuner by having a certain amount of antenna tuning built into the amplifier. With the solid state amplifier, you may well need to include the cost of an antenna tuner as part of your calculation.
Absolutely. And for the benefit of those who, once again, were not present in the tube era, there was also the ritual of neutralization. Would you care to explain what neutralization was?
Sure. We used to have this thing. We'd say, well, every time I try to build an amplifier, I end up with an oscillator. Every time I try to build an oscillator, I end up with an amplifier. Well, the difference between the two is the feedback. If you feedback some of the output signal to the input to an amplifier, if it's in the same phase as what's coming in the input, at some point it will start to oscillate, make its own signal, which sometimes you want that, but in an amplifier stage, you probably don't want that. You want it to not oscillate. So what you need to do is you need to feedback a signal 180 degrees out of phase with that so that it cancels out at the input. The problem is that can be tricky to adjust. Then again, you got to have your fingers in there near the parts.
Yes.
I've had a few real close calls with amplifiers. That's a major problem with triode amplifiers because there's coupling within the vacuum tube itself from the plate to the grid. So you get some coupling in the tube that you have to cancel out. Now, tetrode and pentode amplifiers.
You created a new one.
It's another one, yes. I don't think we'll see too many of those coming out. But have additional elements between the plate and the grid, or the anode and the grid, that tend to reduce the capacity between output and input from the tube itself. But there's still circuitry around it, and you still often have to neutralize it, particularly at higher frequencies. Now, a solid-state amplifier can have the same problem, I guess, but they don't often as much. And I guess partly it's the way they're constructed and the fact that you don't have the same kind of capacitance issues. Actually, I'm trying to think. Well, I mean, obviously you can make a solid state oscillator, so they can be made to oscillate. But I'm not aware of most solid state amplifiers needing neutralization. We talk about solid state devices and so forth. There are a lot of advantages then. We've been talking about how vacuum tubes can do the job, and they certainly can. But solid state devices tend to be smaller, lighter, more efficient. They don't have a filament light bulb type thing filling up the room with heat. They're not as likely to be damaged. A vacuum tube is like a light bulb, and just like a light bulb, it's made so that you can fairly easily remove it. If you remember, remove the voltages mm-hmm. first and put in a new one. And that's handy in a way, but the problem is they're getting harder and harder to find. So while a good transmitting tube can last 10 or 20 years, if you buy a solid-state amplifier, it should last, if you treat it right, it should last essentially forever. There's nothing that is required to fail in a solid-state amplifier if it's designed right. So, you know, think about it. I say, okay, I'm looking at the price of a solid-state amplifier, comparing it to a vacuum tube amplifier. Prices are not that different, but the problem is in 20 years, that tube that's getting hard to find now is probably not going to be possible to find. So you'll end up with a fairly heavy boat anchor, which actually doesn't even work that well as a boat anchor. And actually, you know, solid state devices change too. So if you did fail, have a transistor fail in the output, you might have just as much trouble finding it, but it's less likely to fail as a routine matter in a solid state device. So, you know, my latest amplifier is a solid state amplifier. It's not legal limited. It's a 500 watt amplifier, but I'm expecting it'll outlive me, which that isn't that much of a challenge. But anyway, just a couple of other thoughts to pass
along. Well, are you ready for a question, Joel?
I could take a question.
Well, here's one from Melvin, K3MFP, and he's asking, how do I eliminate unwanted signals from a 2-meter frequency coming from about 50 to 75 miles away? I hear this signal even with my RF gain turned all the way down. It's quite a signal.
That's, well, you know, I've had this exact same problem. So he didn't really say what his conditions were, but my guess is that because that's a quite a distance for a mobile rig to another mobile rig or something, he probably has a base station 2-meter setup with an antenna on the roof or a good antenna. And therefore, he can easily hear that 50-mile away station that he couldn't hear in his car, probably, or with his handheld transceiver. He wouldn't even know it was there. And it happens that at that distance, the frequency coordination folks thought it was safe to have another repeater on the same frequency. So I used to have that in Connecticut, Southwest Connecticut. I would hear in our kitchen 2-meter radio, I would hear repeaters from New Jersey booming in when they were on the same frequency. Mm-hmm. I would also hear stations from my local repeater just as well. And in fact, when they were both on at the same time, if that happened, the capture effect made it so I didn't hear the station in New Jersey, which was handy. But as soon as they stopped talking, then I'd hear the other people. So it was not totally satisfactory. If you're monitoring the repeater, I used to listen for Nancy if she was working and I was at home. So I know when to put the tea water on for her. She's coming home. I've got it on monitoring our local repeater, and I keep hearing signals from New Jersey, and I have to run into the kitchen and see if that's Nancy or if that's somebody in New Jersey that I don't want to talk to. So I got kind of tired of that too. The easiest way may be to see if your local repeater transmits the same kind of CTCSS, or what some people call PL tones, with their transmit signal. Normally we use those to get into the receiver, into the repeater. Or many repeaters rebroadcast those tones on the output side. If not, they probably can if you talk to the repeater control operator or the person that's responsible for the technical team there. They can put out either the same tone or a different tone when they transmit. So then what you do is, if your receiver in the house can be set so that it only opens the receive squelch in the presence of that tone, assuming the station in New Jersey or wherever your 50-mile-away station is doesn't send it out on the same tone, the receiver won't open up when he talks. That's a fairly simple solution. It may be that everything is in place to do that. You just have to program your receiver to receive the tone. But check with your repeater control operator and find out. So that's one thing. Now, another thing you can do, if your local repeater is very close, you could just use a small magnetic mount mobile antenna on the refrigerator, for example. Will probably work to your local repeater both ways, but it probably won't pick up the station from 50 to 75 miles away. So when you want to talk to somebody at distance, you have to switch the antenna. You need an antenna switch or unplug the cable and plug a different one on. So that's a pretty easy thing to do, and that's a handy antenna to have anyway. Anytime you go out in the field or go on a trip, you could take it. And I've put them on filing cabinets or, you know, all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Work very well with a magnetic mount antenna on 2 meters. Not as well as your outside antenna, but that's exactly what you don't want.
Exactly, right.
Application. The other thing you can do is, especially if the repeater that you want to talk to is in a different direction than the interfering signal, you can get a small directional antenna, a 3 or 4 element vertical Yagi. Will have enough 20 or so dB of rejection on the back, and point it towards, or I guess what you want to do is point it away from the station you want to get rid of. So it doesn't matter if the station you want to talk to, your local repeater, is on the side. That's not so big. It'll still work fine there. But what you want to do is put the null towards the station that you want to avoid listening to. And if you really want to have different directions that your antenna responds to, you can put a small rotator on it. And just remember, when you're monitoring your local repeater and you don't want to hear from the guy in New Jersey or wherever your other station is, to turn it so the back of the antenna is facing the station you don't want to hear.
Exactly. Well, thank you, Joel.
My pleasure.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for the doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.